Using Meditation to Unlock My Inner Wisdom. Lecture 15. Every thought that I think is a powerful meditation designed to reveal whatever it is that I think about. Every thought that I think is a powerful meditation designed to reveal whatever it is that I think about. I'll repeat that for you. And lecture 15, every thought that I think is a powerful meditation designed to reveal whatever it is that I think about. Okay. Now, what are the things that you think about? What are the things that you have in your heart? What are the things that are every moment in your consciousness? Are they like getting up in the morning, you know? And are they like going to your job, to your work? Are they like meeting with friends? Are they like going shopping? Are they like taking care of your house? Are they like whatever they are like? Whatever they are like. What do you think is the most important thing in your life? What do you think is the most important thing in your thinking system about yourself, for yourself? And this is something that we really need to pay attention to, because where are our values? Now, we had a fight around the lunch table. And as we were sitting here, we were saying about King Arthur. And did King Arthur have Merlin, the magician, helping him accomplish something? And then we said, okay, well, did the people in Prague, Czechoslovakia, what's their name?
Czechoslovakia.
The people in Czechoslovakia that we went to see under Charles University. They were the alchemists. The alchemists. That's the word I wanted. All right. So then we said, were the alchemists really real? Or were they just a figment of somebody's imagination? And so we were arguing back and forth about the reality of something like this, and whether these things actually take place, and whether they are sincere, and whether they are real, or whether or not. Did King Arthur actually have a Merlin in his court who was doing magic things? They would like to think that's kind of nice if he did. But did he? Did these things actually take place? And the thought that we didn't come up with, but the thought that we could have come up with if we'd stayed with it, was why not? Why not? Why, just because it's a figment of our imagination, does it have to not have been? Did the Beowulf crowd of England really have those stories about the ancient kings of England and so forth? Were they really true? Were the stories about King Henry VIII really true? They sound rather odd. Were the Habsburgs of Germany and so forth, were their kingdoms really true? Was the story about Mozart really true? And how he played music at an early age? And how his father was so surprised? And how the boy was a genius and his sister was a genius and they did play before the courts of Europe? But was that true? Was that true that they were really that good? Did he really write music, never making a mistake in writing down the note? Never erasing a note? That's beautiful if he did. Now, did the golems of ancient Egypt, that's ancient Israel, the golems of ancient Israel and the alchemists of the ancient times, did they really exist? Did these things really? And the answer is yes. What if we have no evidence that they existed? If we have no proof that they existed? We have evidence because people talk about it, but no proof. What if there's no proof? Did they exist? Yes. Anything man can think about, anything man can dream about, anything man can visualize in any way, was, is, true. He is thinking of a real experience, of a real happening. You say, well, that just isn't right. Well, why not? The man who wrote the story about the Titanic, 10 years before it sunk, and even called it the Titanic, and even called it the people sinking by an iceberg at a certain time of the day and a certain month of the year, and at the time that it actually sunk. And he wrote a book about it, and the book didn't sell too well because people didn't believe it, because he was just dreaming, you know. And he was. He was in his consciousness, in his forward mode, and he wrote what actually happened. Now, the record is there. Now, is that fantasy or is it real? Is it real that he did these things or is it not? Well, there are people who say it's not real, and yet it published the book. The book is right there for anybody to look at and see that that's the case. Well, now, when the Titanic went down, nobody made any note of that book. Nobody made any note on it. Only later did they bring it up. And then they didn't bring it up very intently. They just brought it up. Now, why is it we do not like to say strange things come true? Strange things really happen. Why don't we like to say that? Why do we like to say, why don't we? We don't want to say strange things come true. Why is that? Any idea?
So that we don't empower it.
No, it's not because we don't want to empower it, but why don't we want to say that strange things don't come, that come true?
Accentuate the positive.
Speak it in good English for me.
Accentuate the positive, always.
Always keep it positive?
Always.
Well, that's a good idea. But this is not positive or negative, it's just a story. The story of the Titanic sinking. Now, do we have...
Somebody who requires credit for what he has done is not dumb.
How about that? Someone who requires credit for what he has done had not really done it. How interesting.
Did not receive the credit.
He didn't receive the credit. And he didn't. Yeah. For what he intuitively wrote.
Yes.
Now, I see the National Geographic magazine, and every once in a while they have a spread of art in the Great Plains. And in the Great Plains they have beautiful birds, fish, animals mowed out of the fields there, and nobody has mowed it. Nobody, there's no mower marked to it or away from it. There's no mower. And did they bring a helicopter in to bring it in? Now that's interesting. Now let's step back further and go down to Peru, go down to South America, and you have these tremendous airfields that are designed there, where it appears that this was a landing strip, and it went like that, and there's images on the side to show that it was for landing and so forth, and yet... How did it come about? It came about thousands of years ago. Not just hundreds of years ago, but thousands of years ago before we ever had it. Now, is it an out spaceship from outer space? Well, how did they get in and then mark it and then so they could go in and out? Well, that seems a little strange. And but what is it? What is it? There are things of magic that we have no idea. Things of mystery that we have no idea, and we don't even want to know it. Because when we hear what might be the answer, we say, poo-poo, you know, no way, it cannot be that. And we say it cannot be that because we don't want to believe it. We don't want to believe that things actually happen that we know no cause for. How do we begin to look at things and realize that they do actually happen, and they don't need a cause? They do actually happen, and they don't need a cause. So many things. Well, just look at the pyramid, for instance. What good is a pyramid? The silly thing. And they say they built it for the pharaoh. There was no pharaoh strong enough to have men strong enough to take stones and bring them to the pyramid site from somewhere. And they're fit so minusculely on one on top of another, you put a knife blade in there, and most of the time you cannot. Because it's so close, and it's level, it's balanced, it's proper, and it has sunk into the ground maybe a third of the actual height of the pyramid. And Still, the height of the pyramid is so grand. Who did this? Why did they do it? What's the benefit of doing it? Now, have we talked about this? Does there need to be a benefit? Does there need to be a reason for why things are done? Does we have to have a reason why Jesus, hi Jesus, why God put so many sands on this, on the beach, and there are so many snowflakes, you know, without number, and why would those things happen? For what purpose? I mean, if God's going to make something, and he's going to make something good, he'll make it and it'll be done. Then we can use it. But no, it's made and it apparently has no obvious use to it. And we say, what the heck is this? So we disclaim it, discount it, and are discourteous to the thinkers who brought it up in the first place. And yet it is so true. You read the stories of Sherlock Holmes, and it's a fantasy. But you read that, and you think to yourself, what a marvelous mind that person had. What a marvelous thinking ability. What did he do? What did Sherlock Holmes do? He didn't take marijuana. He took some sort of drug, dope of some kind. And he used it regularly. They sold it in the drugstores in those days. And he used it regularly. It opened his mind up to these things, and he was able to be aware of these things. Now, we have to take that kind of drug to open our mind up? No, it's just that our mind can be opened up, and if we open it up, we do know all these things. What is it that closes it? What is it that closes our mind? It's our attitude. Our attitude is what closes our mind, and because our attitude closes our mind, then all these doorways that could be open to us are not open to us. They're not available to us, but we did it to ourselves. Now, can we, through meditation, can we, through introspection, can we, through listening, reading, studying, thinking within, enter into that state of awareness of all that knowledge? Sure. I believe it. I know it. I've seen it happen to me and to others. And have you seen it happen to you and others? Sure you have. Many times you've seen things happen, you just cannot figure out why or how. And you don't try to figure out why and how. If you try to figure out how, why and how, then all you're doing is shutting the door for yourself on what really happened. How did the alchemists work? Why did they work? Why do we have stories coming down through history again and again and again how some men working for the government of ancient kings were trying to turn base metals into gold and were succeeding? And we say, it can't be done, can't be done. Well, today it is done simply and completely by scientists. And you say, then, if they can do it, why don't they do a lot of it? Well, it's more expensive to make the gold than to get the gold. Because changing elements at the moment is a very expensive proposition. Transmuting elements from base to the gold is a very sincere and difficult job because it takes such energy, so much electricity, so much power that it's not worth it. But the point is, it can be done. The point is, it is done. The point is, there is no reason that we should say it cannot be done. And when we start going around practicing the idea, whatever things you think are happening and true and right, there's nothing new under the sun. Yet, the possibility of having everybody speak their word and bring forth what they want, that's the beauty of it. That's the magic of it. And that's the now of it. Yeah. That can be done. I was in the Minier Foundation in Topeka, Kansas, and we were working out at the White Sands Ranch or something or other, where it was nothing to do with atomic energy, and it was just something to do with psychiatric training. Because this is a psychiatric clinic and the Menninger Foundation is one of the major psychiatric foundations of the world. And there, Dr. Green, was working for them, and we were called in as a group of scientists and researchers from around the world to work on internal states of consciousness projects. And we worked on these things with all sorts of fascinating people, like Swami Rama, like I told you. And as we worked on these things, we were studying from many different fields. And one of the fields was auras. We were looking at the energy field of the body. And first we looked at it with our eyes. When we tested it with our eyes, we could see it. We would put a black screen up, and the person would stand in front of it, and then we'd look at the person with sort of hazy eyes, you know, sort of like we're drunk, you know, and looking at the person. And then little by little, the auras would begin to come in. And then we'd turn the lights off and turn the lights on and do a few things, and it played tricks on us, and we began to see the aura so completely. Then they brought electrical instruments in to check the auras. And they were definitely there. They were definitely there. We learned to read the auras of ourselves and others. And then I was working with Dr. At UCLA in Los Angeles, and Dr. Thelma something or other. And she is a great teacher in this field too. Well, she had a camera. And the camera was from this Russian scientist who developed it. And it was for reading your energy level. And the camera, you take your hand and you put it over the plate, and then the camera would take a picture of it. And then after the picture was taken, you could see your energy field. And you could see the energy going out and around and out and around and out and around. And then what we had done, what they wanted to prove, was they took a leaf, an ordinary leaf, and you know, one of the little sprigs of the leaf was cut off, and they put that on this plate. They took a picture of it. Naturally, it was covered up too. They took a picture of it, and lo and behold, that leaf that was cut away was back, because its energy field still was there. So, with you and I, if we lose a finger or something, the energy field is still there. We wonder why we can feel an itch in our leg when we have no leg, or why we feel anything at all when something's missing. Well, these mysteries, these magical mysteries, are just absolutely fantastic. And these magical mysteries are researched and studied by these scientists. Now, they're not proven, but they're researched. They're trying to find out whether it's possible to be true. And they're finding that they cannot find evidence that it's not so. They cannot find evidence that it's so, but they cannot find evidence that it's not so. And they find evidence by the fact that they see the energy field that they can photograph. I still have the photograph of my hand where she took those pictures, and it's really quite fascinating. We had, I think I mentioned it to you possibly before, but blind lady, she's blind from birth. She came into the study room, and when she came in, she was going to be researched. And so she went up to the head desk on the counter and sat with all the other people up there, and she had her seeing eye dog with her. But her seeing eye dog was on the leash, but she wasn't holding him. And so the people in the audience were, oh, look at that nice little puppy. Isn't that a wonderful dog? And pretty soon the dog walks off the stage and starts visiting with the people. And she says to the people, please, that dog is in my vibrations. That dog is my life. That dog guides me through everywhere. He wants to be friendly. He is friendly. He's trained to be friendly, not to be unfriendly. Otherwise, I could never get in anywhere. But please don't call him. Don't encourage him to come visit you, because he's taking on your aura. He's taking on your attitudes. He's taking on disrespect for me. by not staying with me. And I need him. Your enjoyment is only temporary. I need him. So please leave him alone. And they did. And the dog came back to its mistress and was just fine. But before her were held these various construction cards. You know what construction cards are with colored paper on it that the children used in elementary school? And they cut them up and stuff. Well, they had construction cards, which are cardboard that is saturated through the cardboard with the color. And they had red, green, black, blue, orange, and every other color. And they laid them on the table in front of the blind person. And she reached down and picked each one up in order and told us the color, just by feeling its vibration. But when she came to black and she came to white, she couldn't tell it. There were no vibrations coming out of black because black is all color. And there's no vibration coming out of white because white is all color. It is not a distinct color. But those two, she couldn't tell. And even if they were placed randomly here and there while she was looking at these things, she couldn't tell. Now, these exercises, these studies are done by these researchers. And they're so magnificent, so stupendous, but yet they don't prove anything. They just prove that or show that some people can do some things and some things happen and some conditions are aware and it's great. At the Menninger Foundation, too, we had some of the gurus from India there and they were teaching us how to look at the sunlight, to look at the sun. You look around it. You never look directly into it, but you look around it. And this makes your vision, makes your perception, your perceptibility rise to very high levels and very tremendous possibilities. Well, this is things that they're showing us, and they're demonstrating it to us. And we get up and demonstrate it too. And I don't want to repeat these things if I said them before, but I probably have. But we were asked to be in groups, and we were in work groups, maybe about 15, 18 people. And then we would all sit in a circle, and one person would be chosen to get in the middle of the circle because he had a problem. And then we would look at that person, and we would determine what his problem was, where his problem was, how serious his problem was, and so forth. And there was a lot of guessing going on, but a lot of the people, first we walked around him and chanted, you know, I don't remember what we chanted, but we chanted. And after we finished chanting, then we walked around him some more, and we looked at him, and we, you know, just thought about what problem he might have. And then we sat down, like a big circle, all in our squat legs around him. And everybody told what they felt his condition was. And I said his condition was something in his legs that it's a very recent thing and a temporary thing, but it's something in his legs, his upper legs. And after everybody found out what they said, many said other things, but it was revealed that he had had a skiing incident. And in the skiing accident, he had twisted his leg, and it was mending, but it still hurt quite a bit, you know. So we knew that. We had other people lay down and do other things. And we did a whole, maybe during the, I think we were there for 2 weeks. During the full two-week period, we had about maybe 50 experiments there. Then we did the Whirling Dervish. Do you know what the Whirling Dervish is? You know what the Whirling Dervish is? You know what the Whirling Dervish is? I'm not going to tell you. So the Whirling Dervish is a group of people. It's a religious group of people who believe by spinning around that they bring forth spiritual energy from within them. And the Whirling Dervish go back to ancient times. They go back in the early days of Europe. And very, very well-known group. Well, we had a couple of Whirling Dervishers there to teach us. And they taught us how to whirl. And how to whirl until we got so dizzy we'd fall over on the lawn there at the Menninger Foundation. And as we did this, then we got up, if we could, And then we told what we experienced, how we had such strange, exotic experiences that were making us feel very unusual. And here these are medical doctors and scientists and people of repute from all the walks of life, heads of universities and everything coming there. And they all sat through this and were very surprised. But in the process, one of the groups, our group, we had this young Turkish-type-looking guy who was leading our group. And he was leading our group.
The Turkish
man. I'll tell you. I'm trying to be funny. He was leading our group. He may be about 20 years old, 22. And he was leading us and teaching us how to do the whirling dervish dance and how to do all the little things that went along with it. So one morning, I got up early, as I often did, and I went into the kitchen, had a cup of coffee before I went for a walk, and there he was. He was sitting in the early sunlight in the corner of the room, reading a book on the whirling dervish techniques. He didn't know anything about it. He was reading a book about it so he could teach it to us. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm not going to tell anybody. Let's just see what comes. Well, he was good. He was as good as any of the other guys. Maybe all the rest of them didn't know anything either, just read it out of the book. But he read it out of the book and showed us what to do, and we did it. And I just was so amused, you know, because I knew this. Nobody else did it. And here we were being taught by the blind. And all he did was read the book. And we could have read the book, too, but we didn't. We didn't have the book. But it was a good experience, very good experience. And I'll never forget the experiences. And you, too, have had experiences, not perhaps like I have, because they're always different. But I had these experiences because I was ready for it. Oh, we had another guy. We had the... He wasn't the surgery. He wasn't the surgeon with the rusty knife. He was a man who was permitted to go in and observe the surgeon in Brazil, who was operating on people with just a pocket knife. And people would come in with maybe 200 or 300 a day or more, and they'd come into his little surgery, you know, and they'd come up to him and they'd say, I have this or that, and I have the cancer, I have this. And so what he'd do is he'd just lift up their shirt, and then he'd stick his hand into their body and take out the offending tissues and throw them in a dish. And then he'd wave his hand over the hole, and it just healed right up right then. And they were taking photographs of it and motion pictures of it and everything. And it was just utterly amazing. And then he says, okay, go. And no more was said. And he was healed. He was completely not healed. He had a surgery done. And they did this on many, many people. And occasionally he'd have to take in and take his knife out and do something. Why he needed that when he could do all the other things so great. But this man told us how he did these things and told us what he did and showed us pictures of it and showed us a movie of it. And yet, I say, this man said, almost like Edgar Cayce, that he was guided by his doctor. And his doctor was X, so to speak. And a famous doctor that's known, who's dead. And this doctor guides him whenever he does anything and tells him exactly what to do. If the doctor did it in his day, he must have been a miracle being, you know. But this guy did it in this time, and he did it very well. And he did many wonderful surgeries. And many people have gone down, but as of recent years, it's quieted down, primarily because the government of Brazil put a kibosh on it. They want to stop him from doing it. They didn't. You know how the medical profession is. They sometimes want to stop people who are doing things that might be thought to be harmful or might be thought to be coming in on their territory. And so, but these things are happening. These things are taking place. These things are real. And strange as it may seem, these things are real, and these things are what we are dealing with. Now, what do you want to deal with? You want to deal with stuff like that? You want to deal with those things that could make you turned on? Be interesting. Be interesting. But women and men from all over the world went to these doctors, went to these clinics, went to these places in Brazil and South America, went to these men who could do marvelous things. And marvelous things were done for them from all over the world. Now, I am really not continuing my study with that. I'm really not interested in that because I teach a different philosophy. But I believe if you wanted to, you could very readily go and find them. Just look up Arrego, a surgeon with a rusty knife from Brazil, in Wikipedia. And the story will all be there for you. And probably pictures, too, and everything else. It's quite amazing. Orego, O-R-E-G-O, Dr. Orego. No, he didn't, not doctor. He's just a clinician, you know. But doing great things. So, you see, these are things that tickle our fancy. The things of the people who are doing magic work in the underground places of Prague, Czechoslovakia, and Charles University. And those are real things. And if you were to go and check on them for whatever reason, or just because you have curiosity yourself, you'll find if you have humility enough, you can get in and actually see it. But if you don't have humility, if you're going in there, I got to see this here, you know, I'll pay you whatever you want. Tell me, show it to me. They won't show it to you. Because the money that they would make that way would be nothing compared to the money that they could make if they wanted to do mystical things with it. And it would just pile up on them. And it does. It does. You've read in the Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, and you've read how those people are doing such marvelous things, and how they are going into places. If you read in the what's the guy's name up from Mount Shasta? Saint Germain. If you read any of the Saint Germain books, they too are fascinating in this same light. But Saint Germain has been more prominent around the Gobi Desert. And the things that he's done in the Gobi Desert are utterly amazing. But he also did things with the king of France. France. And the king of France tried to have him come and eat with him. And he said, no, I don't eat with anybody. Well, the fact was, he didn't eat anything. And he ran out of money to operate his activity that he was doing at one time in France. And so he went home, and he bought a bunch of diamonds and put them in the bank. Now, where did the diamonds come from?
Magic.
He just took some stones in his hand and crushed them. Or spoke his word. Or whatever he wanted to do. But we all do beautiful, wonderful things that we really can do. And they're fantastic. Now, are you ready to have adventures? Are you ready to do wonderful, strange and wonderful things? You can.
Yes, no? We are doing it. We are doing it.
Oh, yeah. And indeed you are. You are doing it vicariously through me. And if you really look at it further, if you look vicariously through me, you can go deeper. You can go even deeper than I went, because I was there a little bit naive at the time. I was incredulously believing everything they told me, but they had to prove it. And we as a group were, you know, doubtful that they were doing these things. So we did everything we could to make it, for us, a scientific proof. And it did work. It was beautiful. Yeah. in Prague and in London. That is not London. Well, London too, but in Russia, I went to Luxembourg. Not Luxembourg. What is it?
Prague.
Huh?
Prague.
Russia. Okay. Russia. And Prague is in Czechoslovakia.
Okay.
And it is Russia where... it's been so long and time slips on me. But anyhow, they were great adventures and great experiences. And we took books to the Russians on science and on the latest in... And they didn't have any of that because they weren't allowed to have it in Russia at that time. They were just doing their own thing. And their psychiatric hospitals were, so behind the times. But they were effective for them, and they didn't know they could have it any better. And so for them, that was satisfying. But St. Petersburg with this, and Moscow. And Moscow University we went into, and St. Petersburg was named something else at that time. I really shouldn't bring up these names if I don't have them in my tip of my tongue. But I'm reaching for you over a vast field of years, going back into 72, which is not really so long for anybody. But that's a lot. That's a half a hundred.
It's to prove the nowness.
Yes. Okay, then I know it now.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Yeah. You see, she's going to make a winner out of me yet. You think she'll succeed?
Yes.
You think she'll succeed?
Yes.
Hey.
Done.
Oh, she did it. She did it. She did it. It's done. Yeah. You're the one who's pushing that done thing, yeah. And you better live it yourself.
Yes.
And yes, it's done. It's done. And the more I say it's done, then it's done. Yeah. I've been in so many cities in Europe and had such good experiences there. Lenzerheide and Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and I'm trying to think of the L ones. But they were all sort of fantastic and all sort of great. Lisbon, Lucerne, Lugano, And all these cities were glorious occasions. Now, let's see what our time is. I keep walking away with my time here. Oh, we're good. Okay. We were in Lugano, and we went to a monastery in Lugano, which was run by an abbot, or a man alone, and he rented the monastery to us for our seminar. And so we had 40 people perhaps there, and we all had cells, and we were fed by the monastery. And then we had the great cathedral of the monastery as our place for the om. So you can imagine what that was like. So we would push the furniture aside, the altar tables and so forth, and they allowed us to do it. We asked permission, of course. And then we'd hold our om there. And then we also did our dancing there. We had dancing there. We had with scarves and so forth, letting loose of energies and releasing stuff. And then we went downstairs. And downstairs... I believe this was the right chapel. We've been in so many monasteries. But there was a beautiful marble chapel down there, maybe three times the width of this one room here, which is a good width, And then the length of it, exceedingly long, maybe 200-300 feet. And so we were in there, and we had our dancing in there, because there was more room, and it's all ready for us. And so we would go in there. Oh, yes, we had our three-hour meditation there. We had our three-hour meditation, and then we had our Om, and then we had our dancing. And in that, it was so fantastic. We had people coming year after year for the program because it was such a uplifting. That was where Ellen first came to the program at that monastery. And she was going to, hoi polloi, you know, she's such a rich bitch, you know, and she was just going to stay for one evening. And she was not going to stay in a monastery, in this cell, you know. She had this beautiful gold marble home that she lived in, you know. And so she came. And then she saw what we were, we had seven medical and psychiatric doctors there for this one program. And so she was there during that program. And at the time, she was watching what we did and seeing all the neat things we did, but she went home, which was not too far away, maybe about 5-10 miles. And so afterwards, while she goes home, she said to her husband, I got to go back. I got to participate in that program. And she did. And from that moment forward, she is one of our group, just fantastic. And she brought all her friends. And they were just wonderful. And we talked about this philosophy. We demonstrated this philosophy. But the wonderful thing of it, of having a bunch of medical doctors there, was that these medical doctors all spoke up and gave cooperative information of what I was saying, and then they spoke it and told how it worked, told how it functioned for them, told how it did magic things for them. And that was really, boom, you know, wonderful, supportive evidence that was so helpful. And that's the kind of thing that you're talking about, something that brings back knowledge, wisdom, and proof to them, to you, to all the world of what you're doing and how you're doing it. And it's exciting. Like I said, Ellen just became so a wizard on this here, and so enraptured in it, that she attended all of the programs. And we did have some meaningful programs and met some very wonderful people who told us of their experiences with stem cells, of their experiences.
At that time. Yeah.
No, it was naturally just primitively thought about. We didn't have all the information that we got later, but it came up. Well, you know, it comes up. You don't know. If you listen to some of my old tapes and some of my old lectures, you'll hear things and you'll say, golly, he was just a little ahead of his time. My research was good. I listened within. But it's fun. And it's not only fun, it's rewarding insofar as you feel good about yourself. You feel you're really doing something significant. You feel that what you're working on is something meaningful and something truly proof. It's just wonderful. Just wonderful. I could go on giving you adventures like this, but I know that there comes a time you might have a question or two. Did you have any thoughts of anything that I said? I'm not trying to just whirlwind you into my life story here, but it's wonderful. I tell these stories.
We are getting to understand what the lecture is saying. Every thought that I think is a powerful meditation designed to reveal whatever it is that I think about. Which means, go and think your thought and see it done. We have no more limitations, except we want to limit ourselves.
And what is your question?
My question is that we have my thought is that we have no more limitations, except we want to limit ourselves.
Yeah.
We are unlimited in whatever we want to experience and see done.
Well, what are you saying? Are you saying that we are limiting ourselves, or we do know it, or we don't know it?
We are no longer limited. We now know.
We know we're not limited.
Mm-hmm. We are aware now that we are unlimited.
Okay, we are aware now that we are unlimited, and that's true. And that goes along with that statement here. Every thought that I think is a powerful meditation designed to reveal whatever it is that I think about, anything I think about.
Yes.
And that's why I took you on this little rambling journey here.
Since anything we think about is a possibility,
yes,
is done.
Well, I like the word possibilities, but I don't like it. Because possibility means that it has never happened. Rather, I don't know what word you'd use, but some other word that wouldn't say it may not have been done. A possibility.
No, I'm coming from, normally we may say it is impossible.
Oh, you're coming from just that statement alone.
Possible.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, well, to the term that it is possible.
Yeah.
Okay, now, how is it possible?
Because we now see beyond and see it done. As we see the original purity and integrity, it is done.
No.
And that's what we are now looking for from now.
As we look beyond and see the original purity and integrity and see it done, as we do this, it takes a little bit of practice.
Yes.
It takes a little bit of practice and a little bit of consistency of believing in yourself. And that practice and consistency of believing in yourself, you develop by saying to yourself, I know that I know that I know. The divine in me knows the answer. By saying to yourself, I am all knowledge, all wisdom, all I am the allness. I am the one. And when you say that, then you keep saying it to yourself until it no longer sounds silly, until it no longer sounds ludicrous, you know. And you move out of that area into the area of it's done. It's done. Now, when will you ever see a person walk on water when they know where the stones are?
It's done.
Hmm?
Done all the time.
It's done all the time, people walk on water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they water ski using other principles, but they water ski, and that's kind of interesting.
Yes.
Now, what else? What else? They walk on fire, calling it a different name. Just calling it a different name, and it's not real, it's not right, it's not correct, it's totally wrong, wrong, wrong. You cannot just say, this is it's cool, wet moss, and have to be cool, wet moss. Ha, 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 ha. You sure can. People do it all the time. And when they do it, what happens? It's cool, wet moss for them. Now, what if you were to start saying, with the same enthusiasm of cool wet moss, just that simple, one evening training program, if you were to say, my body is always satisfied. My body is always satisfied. I always have sufficient nourishment in my body, sufficient energy, sufficient everything in my body to operate at peak performance. What would happen? We could do it.
Yeah.
We could do it.
It's done.
And if we did it, if we really applied it, we could have it. Now, is that important to you? And that's the question. Is it important to you? Because when it becomes important to you, and then you apply it, then you do it, and then the next step, Chioma, the next step, you don't tell anybody else about it. Because you're living in a world where nobody else is doing that except you. And if somebody else comes up and says, what are you doing? You say, oh, come on, you're crazy. You're not doing that. Prove it. Show me. You know. And then all you're doing is spending your life proving to other people what you know you do and you do it. And so we just don't tell other people. And how many people are doing it now that are not telling other people? We have people in the Arizona desert who are going without food and water. Food and water in the desert. And they're doing it for several years already, you know. Now, they're being tested by science, but the thing is, they're not making a big thing out of it. Why? Why? The people are doing it for
themselves.
They're doing it for their own inner delight, their own inner appreciation of the fact that they are mastering an avenue, an area of divine consciousness that they don't know of anyone else who's ever done it. And, we've done it. You know? And of course, they don't have pride. It's just delight. And it's not important. And how can they afford to do that? Because they don't have to pay water. They don't have to buy water. They don't have to buy food. They just live. It's wonderful. My goodness sakes. We have before us the entire world. How did Moses feed the teeming people he took out of Egypt to the land of milk and honey? How did he feed them? Coming through the desert where there was nothing. There was no food. Coming through the desert where there were no plants. There were a few cactuses maybe. And 40 people, well, not 40 people, but however many he had. He had quite a few people. And what happened? And why did he go 40 days and 40 nights? Why did he go more than that? Why did he go 40 years? Why? So that the older generations could die out. The older generations that knew about slavery and appreciated slavery and said, why don't we go back there? It's a heck of a lot better than out here, you know. And so they died out, and their children were raised in this here. And so their children were raised in the idea that it can be done. And Moses was an imposing figure. And he spoke to them and he said, this is what we're doing. This is who we are. And they believed. And they followed him. But the older generations, fortunately, they died out. They couldn't take that freedom. Couldn't take that land of milk and honey they hadn't arrived at. But again, you see, we're always doing miraculous things. Now, is it true that Moses and whoever was the Pharaoh at that time, that they were having a fight between themselves and that they turned the river into blood and they turned the sea, whatever it is, into snakes, and they had snakes all over the place and they had all sorts of problems? Is that true?
Possibly. If it is a thought.
I'm sorry?
As a thought, it is true.
Well, no. They recorded it. And they recorded it in their attractive style of writing.
Yes.
And they made it sound like everybody was experiencing it, where perhaps one or two were. And Moses got what he wanted, and the people had no right to stay behind because they had to come. They didn't want to go with Moses. They didn't want to leave the freedom that they had in slavery. Because in slavery, they didn't have to worry about housing or clothing or anything else that was given to them by the government.
Yes.
All they had to do was work. And many died while their work was so. That's just part of the game. But the story that's told and the story that is certainly two different things. I'm not going to say it didn't happen. But I am going to say that it probably didn't happen quite in the way that we have the story that tells it. Like the story of the Red Sea, where they crossed the Red Sea. It probably didn't happen quite in the way. But then again, we can walk on water. We can walk on the fire. So could he teach his people in one evening or two how to walk across the Red Sea, right on top? And then, of course, they made it like the Red Sea opened up for them and it did all this stuff. And maybe it did. Maybe it did. I mean, that'd be a neat way to have it do.
Masters of the Far East.
Yeah, and it would certainly make them all believers, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it would certainly chase away the Pharaoh's men who were trying to chase them.
Yeah.
They got caught up in the vortex of water that was the back world of the sea. And they make the sea into some gorgeous, magnificent sea where the Red Sea is not a gorgeous, magnificent sea. It's okay, but it's just a big old dirty lake, you know. But again, these are the stories we have. These are the things that were told. Now, they make things sound miraculous. They make miracles where there may not have been miracles, but they also make miracles where there were miracles, where things really were a miracle. And what would be a miracle in your mind about the people of ancient times? That they lived healthy, happy, hearty lives?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be a miracle?
Yes.
And they did. They did. They lived healthy, happy, hearty times. How? They lived... Yeah, go ahead.
They think wholeness and they have it.
Yes. But you see, the thing is, what we have to consider is they didn't want what we want. They didn't need the things we need. Their needs were so minuscule, so tiny, so unimportant compared to ours today. Like your son, he couldn't get along without that computer now. He'd drive you mad if you took that away, if he couldn't have it for some reason, you know. He'd go find another mother. But, I mean, we live in a different era. We live in a different age because with different demands, different needs, different wants. And they didn't know what they didn't have. But what, we didn't finish Moses off in the desert with the people. What did he feed the people?
Manna.
And what is manna? Manna is the invisible fruit of the desert that appears only when you need it.
Yes.
Interesting, huh? The invisible fruit of the desert that appears only when you need it.
Why don't we have it now? Why don't we have it here?
We do, but you don't need it. You got enough food here to feed an army, and you're only feeding a navy, you know. You don't need it, and you wouldn't eat manna if you had it. Now, what does this character do when she's at home? Yeah, she's at home. Does she eat yogurt at home? No. At home, she has plenty of other things that she eats that please her totally.
Yeah.
And then when she comes here, she has all this variety of food, so she joins in the party. And it's not because she wants it, but it's because it's here and it's a party time, you know. I come to Europe, I eat stuff with you guys that I would never eat at home. Never. But you serve it, I eat it, and it's not going to kill me. And some things are I can't tolerate, but most things are just beautiful. But for you, it's fine. But for me, it's different. And so I just join in with you. I don't think, I like it, I don't like it, I just eat it, you know. And when I'm sitting down there in Nigeria, oh my God, she brings out a plate full of food fit for a king, you know. I mean, it's all my type of food. And so can I sit at her table and not clean my plate? You know, it's impossible. And then she comes there to make sure I do and sits there next to me and drinks a cup of tea while I eat. And she makes sure that I eat everything. You know, she's not going to let me get away with putting it down for the dog that they don't have. You know, at home, I can give Rex my goodies. You know? Yeah. And he loved it. But you see, these are all miracles. You think, Herb, how did you eat all that stuff when you were there, and now you're home, and you're not eating a third of that? Well, that's what I usually prefer, is a third of the food as a diet. But, hey, I'll get by, you know. I'll get back home. When I got home from your house, I think I had gained 1/2 pound. 1/2 pound, you know. And I ate a lot of silly stuff with you, you know, a lot. And when I got home, the first thing I did is what? Went over to Denny's and had a steak, you know. And it was nice. It was very nice. Then I went home, and then they had supper. And I said, that's fine. You have your supper, you know. I had my steak. But Denny's had such nice steaks. But again, and when I got home, they're like you. They just try to power me with this and show me with this. And they want me to eat what they want to eat. Whatever their pleasures are, they tell me to eat that. and they want me to eat what they eat so they can buy more of what they want, you know. And that's good. They're smart. They're smart. But not smart enough. Because I just take whatever they give me, and I eat what I want, and then I take the plate. You know, Rick, we have a big corn board bowl. You know what a corn board bowl is? It's like made out of corn board. And it's shaped a big, big bowl for salads and stuff. So we haven't used it for years. So I thought, that would be a good bowl to have on the floor right next to me for Rex. So I take Rex's bowl, I set it there, then I take my plate when I'm done eating, and you know, it's still got a little bit on it, you know, and I take it and I put it in this big bowl because he has a tendency to scarf it up with his tongue and everything goes flying, you know, and so it doesn't get on the walls this way. And he eats it and cleans it, and then he cleans the bowl, and then that's fine. And when I put yogurt down for him, or when I put like breakfast food down for him with a little water and shoop, 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 you know, it stays inside the bowl. Yes. So it works out very nice, very nice. And then he has a water bowl over there. It's a big thing like this here, and the cats drink out of it, and their little Love drinks out of it, and Rex drinks out of it, and we have a plate, a big tray beneath it, so that it catches the overflow of water. So it makes it all nice. Oh, I was going to tell you. Okay. Christy is going crazy with thinking of a new carpet here and new this here and new that there. Well, Ellen is too. Ellen is thinking of changing the carpet in the dining room because the carpet is hard for Ingeborg to roll the rolling chairs around at the table, you know, to pull it into the table to get in there and stuff like that. So she is thinking of buying a hardwood floor that you put in yourself, you know, and put it in there, and put it in, and probably put it in just a half an hour or so, and you pull out the carpet, you pull out the under rug, and then you make it all nice and clean, and then you put this down, blip, 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 and it's all done. Her grandchildren did this in Lugano, and they liked it very much. But then she says, it's so much easier to wipe up. And then he said, then Rex won't get anything on the floor. And I said, yeah, but just be careful. If he comes running in here like he does and rushes around, and then he stops and doesn't stop, and the table goes up to the chairs, go. I said, we'll have fun. But this is what is living.
Yeah. This like, is not. Like
what's that?
Like sliding across the
floor. Oh, yeah, that's sliding. And it's a beautiful floor. Yeah. It's from Home Depot.
And he'll be coming and loving it.
Yeah, our dining room is about the size of this room here. And so it'd make it a good size. Yeah. But they may have put it in already while I'm gone. And I hope that they have.
You meet a new home.
Yeah, right. I hope that they have. I know that it'll be good. All right, any other questions?
No.
At the moment?
No.
Okay, just feel free to answer them whenever they come up, because I'll be happy to hear what your answer is.
Okay, thank you.
I love you.
Thank you.
You're great.